Welcome to the Thursday night special here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Kansas City author and activist Monique Gabrielle Salazar recently returned from her second trip to Standing Rock, North Dakota, to stand in solidarity with the water protectors against the Dakota Access Pipeline. On Monday, January 30th, Monique relayed her experiences at the Uptown Arts Bar.
How is everyone
Let's
doing
listen,
tonight?
Shall we?
Yay. That was kind of enthusiastic. I know we've had a rough week in this here country of ours, so I do apologize for everything that's going on in this country, even though it's not my fault. I'm still just common empathy. It's been a rough week. So my name's Monique Gabrielle Salazar. Some of you may know me through the Arts Bar. I do bartend here two nights a week on Thursdays and Fridays. We have the best karaoke in town. And I only speak the truth, so you know it's true. I also own the Scullery Maid at 5532 Truce, which is a vintage clothing store. I'm also a poet and am finishing my second book's manuscript. It's due on the 1st, so I technically should be writing right now. But don't tell my editor. Her name isn't Jeanette Powers, and she isn't in the building. Except that she's over there. So anyway, but I wanted to come and talk to you about what is going on in Standing Rock right now. Who here saw the first talk, either was here or saw it on Facebook? Okay. Are we all pretty familiar with the Standing Rock story and kind of what's been going on? I see a lot of nodding of heads. Okay, good. All right. It's kind of hard because things change so much at camp from day to day that people are on all different levels of knowledge of what's going on up in North Dakota. So, of course, the best way to know what's going on is to go there. So this was my second trip up there. The first time that I went was in November. We went over what, you know, quote unquote, Thanksgiving weekend. We stayed there that week. And so this is my second time going back, and I just got back about, lost all track of time in the past week and a half, got back about 3 days ago. I was in camp for 5.5 days and spent the rest of the time in a pretty harrowing adventure. So I'll start out with the beginning. Making it up there is a rather lengthy drive, and I chose to go on the route that's a little bit shorter, but also through all of the back roads. So that was a little bit terrifying to get up there because they are two-lane roads and there are no lights and you're like the only person for miles around. So it's a little Deliverance style creepy, but we made it, or I made it. And when I got to camp, the last time that I was at camp, it was when a bunch of people had started flooding in to help support the camp. So when I was there, there were about, I would say around 8,000 to 9,000 people. We did a count of the women and children alone while I was there, and it was 6,000. So women and children plus men, there had to be at least 9,000 at camp. The biggest that camp got was when the veterans went up there on December 4th. There were 15,000 people up at camp. So unfortunately, I wasn't there, so I can't describe that experience to you. But from what I've heard from people that were there, it was very, very chaotic. So it's also when the blizzards hit. So that's always fun to walk into a blizzard. So when I was there, I drove into camp. And it's pretty obvious that there's not so many people there anymore. There's a lot of permanent or semi-permanent structures like teepees and little buildings that they've constructed and tents of all kinds, but they're like the bigger, stronger army tents. Pretty much you would not have survived the winter in the kind of tent that I brought, which was okay because I wasn't planning to be there all winter. But it struck me as odd because when I went in there, it looks kind of like the rapture happened in a lot of ways. When the blizzards came, lots and lots of people just left and didn't come back to their campsites at all. And so it's this very eerie kind of Old West ghost town feeling. There's a lot of tents that are like, you know, caved in by snow. There's, you know, remnants of people's campsites just kind of strewn about strewn about. And so part of my mission to go back up there was to help clean up this mess that has been left behind, because the tribe is very, very conscious of it. And they've actually gotten a drone again. Their first drone was stolen by the police, but they've gotten another drone. Hopefully this one stays under the native control for a little longer than a week. But they've used it to map out where trash is at camp, so they know exactly where they need to go in and do that. So me as a single person, not being, you know, incredibly large or muscular, unfortunately, I like to think that I am, but, you know, I get in fights and I get proven wrong. That was my main mission, was to pick up trash. So, but when I first got there, I want to send a shout out to Nichelle Nichols and Locally Sourced Meats. They gave me a bunch of meat to go to camp with, and everyone was so happy to see the meat. So it was a really cool experience. I was the meats girl around camp for the first couple days. I was like, oh, you're the girl at the meats. And I'm like, yeah, it was me and my cooler, you know. So that was really neat. They donated a lot of meat. So thank you to both of those sources for the meat. We also raised a bunch of money to buy meat from McGonagall's, because they have these special cool freezers that keep the meat frozen for a long time. So everyone that donated to that, thank you so much. We took them steaks and steak tips and all kinds of good stuff. So they were really, really happy about that. I also took up a bunch of firewood from one of my friends, Matthew Rutledge. So thank you, Matthew, for the firewood. Definitely kept the sacred fire going, because that's immediately where I took it, because they were running low on wood. So besides digging, you know, tents out of the snow, which isn't inherently a very interesting activity, although I did find a Kansas City Chiefs cup in this camp that I spent 2 days digging out of the ice. So whoever that is, you totally owe me a steak dinner. Like, you do. I'm sorry. It took me an entire 2 days to get all your crap out of there. So while we're going through the campsites, though, we're very conscious of what can still be used. A lot of camps sort of got overwhelmed with donations, so they're actually putting together a bunch of donation packages to send to, you know, local places, homeless shelters, other places on the reservations. So they've been, you know, dividing all of that kind of stuff and taking it out little by little. So when we take down the campsites, we try to preserve everything that we possibly can that could be used. What's hard about camp is that people have been there for so long that it's sort of in like a scavenging mode now. So if like you need something or something breaks, you can't necessarily just go to the store and get it, because A, you probably haven't had a job in a few months, and B, it's hard to get out of camp and back in safely. So what we would do is put all of the stuff that still could be used out in front of the dumpsters, and then we threw everything else out. So right before I left, it was I was watching videos on the internet, which I shouldn't have done. But it was the they had actions on Monday and Wednesday, and I left from Kansas City on Thursday. And these were really, really violent actions on the side of the police. A lot of people were shot. A lot of people were hit with beanbag rounds. A lot of thieves, the LRAD. The LRAD system is a terrible system. It makes really, really loud, high-pitched noises that can cause hearing loss. So that was one of the weapons that they had out there that night, those two nights. So when I got there, everybody was still kind of, you know, in recovery mode from those 2 days of action. There were quite a few arrests, and I met 2 people that have been shot in the eye. And I mean, it's like they were both shot like right about here. And it just made their entire eye just black until like here it would turn green. But don't tell me they don't know where they're aiming, basically. While I was there, I was really lucky to stumble upon the UN. The UN was at Standing Rock to sort of give a training session on how to deliver testimony at the UN. So they offered this at the casino, which is about 20 minutes away from camp. So myself and a couple other campers, we just all hooked it up to the casino for these 2 days. The first day, they gave us presentations on what the police call non-lethal weapons. And this study was an international study done by INCLO. And INCLO is also made up of, like, the ACLU is a part of it, CELS in Argentina. There's quite a few other countries that are on board. So they did this international study about non-lethal weapons. So I'm going to kind of go through the list with you all, because I'm sure you've heard about these things being used against people at Standing Rock, and they're a lot more dangerous than they would like us to think. So the first one is rubber bullets. And I want to impart on you that rubber bullets are live rounds that are coated in rubber. And that's what a rubber bullet is. So when you're getting shot with a rubber bullet, you're getting shot. Same thing with a plastic bullet. It's just a coating. And when you're out in North Dakota, the rubber around the bullet freezes and shatters upon impact. So let me tell you how dangerous that makes those things. Rubber bullets have caused deaths, and they've caused a lot of injuries. Obviously, getting shot in the eye is a very good way to become injured from one of those. There was another girl that was shot in the eye. I believe it was on November 20th that she was shot in the eye. And she's from Arizona, and she can't return home because the altitude of her home is too high. It would cause further damage to her eye if she were to go home. So she's actually in Chicago getting some surgeries, but she wrote a testimony that was read aloud at the UN unofficial hearing the next day. So hopefully she's going to get better. Her name is Susie. Her real name is Vanessa. You've heard of that. So the next one I'm going to talk about is the LRAD system. Like I said, the LRAD system is designed to basically confuse you. It's an incredibly, incredibly loud burst of sound that can cause hearing loss, has been shown to cause hearing loss. And basically, it's to cause more confusion, more panic and fear among protectors so that, you know, things get disorganized, because when things get disorganized, people are more inclined to get hurt. I do want you all to be aware that Kansas City Police Department does have one of these devices. They haven't used it yet, but they do have possession of one. So just to let you know. Let's see. So water cannons. Let's talk about water cannons. Can anyone tell me where water cannons were first used? Does anyone know? A little farther back. 1930s Germany. They were used to dispel riots and crowds. And if you know a whole lot about 1930s Germany and the quote-unquote riots that they were trying to get out, a lot of those were the LGBTQ community from clubs and the nightlife in Berlin. So that's where water cannons were developed. They were first just water hoses, and now they have entire tanks that they build that... that's their sole purpose, is to spray high-pressured water on crowds. The problem with water cannons is that a lot of the times it's not just water coming out of the cannons. There's many, many documented cases of them adding UV dyes to the water so that they can catch you after you've run away, because you'll light up. There was another place where they filled it with skunk water. It was really odorous. And they sprayed an entire neighborhood down with it, and you just, like, couldn't go outside because everywhere stank. They've also added other, you know, pesticides, fertilizers, all kinds of chemicals to them. So when you're hearing about people getting sprayed with water cannons, it's not only a blast that's hard enough to scrape the flesh from your hands, it's also probably contaminated with something else. So Another one that we can talk about is combustion grenades. Those are supposed to just create like a loud flash and a bang to kind of clear people away from an area. What the police are doing in Morton County are pulling the pins, holding on to it until it just is about to explode, and then chucking it into the crowd of protectors. This is how Sophia Wolanski, who's a 21-year-old protector from New York, pretty much almost lost her arm. It's still there, but she's got to go through a lot of extensive surgeries that I can't even imagine. But I saw a picture of her arm, and they had to put skin pretty much like all down there like that. It was really brutal. And the other problem was that the police were blocking any sort of emergency services getting to the injured water protectors at camp for 2 hours. So they also have something that's really terrifying called the disorientation device. And I'm not entirely clear on how this works, but they're going to start shooting people with energy like Star Trek. So they apparently already have these devices, but they're not tested. And that's the problem with most of these devices is that they're developed for military use, including pepper spray, bear mace, et cetera, all that they've used on the water protectors. These are all military developed, but they can't be used by the military because you cannot use chemical warfare in battle. But it's perfectly acceptable to use chemical warfare against the citizens of your own country when they stand up to protect their land and their water. I don't know. So the conclusion of this report is that these non-lethal crowd control weapons, as they like to call them, are actually about 3% of the time lethal, 17% of the time serious injury, and 15% of the time life-altering injury. So these crowd control and quote-unquote non-lethal weapons that they're using really are not called for in any sort of area that I can see or any future direct action that I could imagine. Like the forces that have been used against the water protectors up in North Dakota, it is a war. And unfortunately, it's not a war on the Sioux side, but it is most certainly a war for the Morton County Police. The other ways that camp has kind of gotten a little scarier is they're doing snatch and grabs now. And let me tell you how fun this was being alone at camp when they were doing this. I was warned not to go too far out of the reaches of camp because as someone who's by myself, I am very prone to be snatched and grabbed, which is where the police have all these snowmobiles and fancy snow machines that they go about. And, you know, they're obviously allowed to come on our side, which is how they, you know, ripped elders out of the sweat lodge and, you know, have done all sorts of horrible things. But they've been coming up and grabbing people. A week ago, they were shooting kids off of their horses with rubber bullets and then arresting them. When I got back from camp, someone that I had met at camp the previous time that I went had just gotten back to camp, and he was doing sort of a prayer patrol on what would be considered camp land. And he was surrounded by snowmobiles with tons of police, and they just all jumped onto his truck and pulled everyone in the truck out, arrested them all, and took them to Bismarck. So it's becoming even more and more like a dystopian novel. Like, I can't believe that I'm sitting here and telling you that this is happening in my country in 2017. It's really ridiculous to me that I have to, that this is even coming out of my mouth, that this is even a situation. So the UN testimony was hard to sit through because it's, you know, a lot of people and their experiences compounded. There are people that have been shot several times. They set up a prayer camp on October 27th. The police came over and bulldozed that. They took all of the elders and set them on the side of the road in handcuffs and took pictures of them while they were in handcuffs. And then they took them to, this is the incident with the dog kennel that everybody's talking about. These people were taken to Morton County Police Department and they were put in dog kennels and they know it's a dog kennel because there's a picture of a dog on the wall. And they asked, why is there a picture of a dog on the wall? They were like, well, you're in the kennels because we have nowhere else to put you. So they weren't even booked at that point. They actually drove them up north. Let's see if I can find it. He drove them up north about 2 hours away and put different, they marked them with numbers. They destroyed all of their sacred objects. They covered them in tarps at night. They strip searched everyone. And when I mean everyone, I mean like the elders. So, I mean, they don't even do that when you go in there for a drug offense. So they shipped them to Devil's Lake and finally booked them there. Most of them were charged with, you know, resisting arrest and, you know, disturbing the peace and all this other stuff. They eventually got all of them out from there. One of the problems that people are finding, though, with being arrested and having to go through court trials is that they're ordered to not leave North Dakota. And then a lot of their cases are being postponed indefinitely. So you have, I think there's probably about 100 to potentially about 600 people, that's how many has been arrested so far, that are going to be stuck in North Dakota with no resources and really like kind of no place to stay. So what I really want to talk about is, because I want everyone to know this, is that they are spraying the camps with poison. And there's 4 different poisons, actually. The first one is called Rosol. And it's a poison that was used to ostensibly kill prairie dogs that were out on the landowner's land. Prairie dogs, you know, obviously bury in the ground, and they're a risk for horses and buffalo who can step in the holes and break their legs. So killing a bunch of prairie dogs really isn't that rare. What is a little bit rare is using 40,000 pounds of this poison to kill some prairie dogs. And this is a poison that you can't just go and buy. It has to be bought by the government. So I'm pretty sure we all can figure out where they got that from. The little airplane that used to put around camp the first time that I was there is no longer there. But what is happening is that after actions, they're being woken up at 2:30 in the morning because there are airplanes dive bombing camp. So I don't really see another reason for them to be dive bombing camp with airplanes unless they're letting something loose. One of the people that gave testimony at the UN unofficial hearing had her hair tested. And she arrived at camp on November 20th, which was, I believe, 4 days before we got there. And I'm probably going to butcher the names of these chemicals because my high school chemistry teacher spent the entire time on the newly invented AOL Instant Messenger talking to his new girlfriend, so I didn't learn a lot. okay, so number one is phosphine, which is a pesticide. I was real excited about this one because it causes liver damage and jaundice, and I already have liver cirrhosis, so I was real excited to learn about that one. The second one is a castor of pumice, which is a white powdered fertilizer. And the other one is trioclide propane, which is a fertilizer and a solvent for degreasing paint. And I just came across this video yesterday. This is one of the gentlemen I met up at camp. Colin, you think you can play that video? Okay. We're just going to listen to the sound of it.
I'm going to turn this around and drop my rubber slipper there. I keep losing it.
And this is at camp.
So can you introduce yourself and let us know what has been happening, what's been going on, and some of your finds with some of the things you were telling me about the types of chemicals that they've been using and to be aware of, to be tested of?
Excuse me. Good way to start the interview. I'm Kenny Frost. I'm a Native American consultant. I've been up here in South Dakota for quite some time. coming and going periodically, and just for Christmas was up here 8 weeks or so, or something like that. You lose track of time, because during our ancestors' days, there was no such thing as time, so same thing holds true. You eat when you're hungry, and you try to get up as early as you can, but that's the way camp life is. The unfortunate thing is that our people who have been camped here since April, here at Sacred Stone, when it started on April 1st of last year with 7 people, and then jumped up to 45 people, and then jumped 5,000% to 15,000 on December the 4th, is a testament. And having people from all over the world, including some of the smallest countries around Mother Earth, to be here to stand with the people. Everybody has been subjected to various abuses from Morton County, Dane County, Cass County, and Bismarck, North Dakota Police. And then we also had the FBI, alcohol, tobacco agents, Homeland Security, and other federal law enforcement agencies. And sadly, those people were monitoring, watching, making sure our civil rights, our constitutional rights, our due process wasn't being violated by Morton County or North Dakota, where basically everything here in North Dakota, there's no such thing as rights. People's rights are trampled on each and every day, especially during actions. There's been people being abused, shot at a distance of 5 feet, shot in the head, shot in the ear. So we're having those types of issues happening here, and there's not a damn thing anybody can do. And I have to be perfectly honest when I say damn thing, because those rights, nobody has those rights here in North Dakota. You have federal prosecutors, you have federal judges, you have law enforcement from outside this area who cannot believe that nobody has rights, because you can't do that. You don't aim a weapon at somebody who's unarmed, but yet that happens on a daily basis. And since last summer, one of the interesting things is that the people here have been sprayed, and now the documentation is slowly getting out, where people are sprayed with chemical biological warfare by North Dakota. And for such a long time, even during the summer, people who are coming down with the, what we call the DAPO cough, And we figured that maybe one of the reasons the people were coming down with the DAPO cough was due to the fact that maybe they were at the actions where tear gas was used, pepper spray was used. But no, there's people here at the camp who take care of the camp, who are constructing, or even elders who are doing different things and taking care of the camp, and along with the small kids, that everybody came down with what's known as the DAPO cough. It wasn't until last week when we finally started receiving word from people getting checked out by their doctor with a blood testing, hair testing, that the DAPO cough is really from rat poisoning that is being sprayed over the camp. If you remember this past summer at some of the actions at St. Anthony, the crop duster was spraying chemicals on the water protectors and defenders. Well, Morton County, North Dakota stated that there was no chemicals being used at that time. And if you looked at the pictures, it was late summer, all the crops had basically been harvested. So why was there reason to spray? Well, lo and behold, as I mentioned last week, people have got tested and found out that it's an offshoot of rat poisoning. With the symptoms of rat poisoning, you develop a cough. It's basically microscopic fiberglass that attaches to your lungs and cause you to become irritated. And a lot of people in December came down with pneumonia, which is also another symptom of rat poisoning. We met with the UN, United Nations people, and they called the chemist who works around the world for biological chemical warfare. We gave her the symptoms that people have succumbed here at the camps was that the big camp over here at Sacred Stone, and she knew immediately that it was rat poisoning, and also gave us the same symptoms. Now we have a military person who does black ops, who done black ops, who was checked out by the hospital. Of course, we need to ask him more questions, but he basically also confirmed that uranium-235 was also used in minute small dosages, but yet it's still uranium. And if you know uranium with the Navajo coal miners, and even in South Dakota, a lot of those people who were working in the uranium fields ended up having cancer. So this is some of the things that we're finally getting out. We're finally understanding people are getting blood tests. And then another sergeant who was in the military also said the same thing, that uranium 235 is also used. So we have confirmation from two various vets, both in various branches of service, but yet don't know each other. So when people don't know each other and saying the same thing, there's a pretty good likelihood of high 90% that what's being told to us is actually true. We contacted, we attempted to try to get CDC, Center for Disease, to check, but because it's a governmental agency, North Dakota's a governmental agency, that the independent testing from them would not come back positive. Because samples can get lost, it's a government agency, and not saying that CDC cares about what happens here, but we're kind of leery. So why we were getting tested by the United Nations, and so hopefully we're going to start getting results. The sad part is that there's a lot of people out there who ended up having pneumonia. They end up getting well, and then they end up getting it back again. So it's a cough, especially with pneumonia, that comes and goes. You get strong, you get well, then you're sick again. So it's a lingering type of disease. So this has been happening not only to the people here, but there's been a lot of water protectors and defenders who have gone home and have not been back, and to this date are still coughing. They stated that they went home, they got well, then it came back again. So a lot of people are, and what we've been telling them is you need to go in and get a blood test. You need to have your hair tested. And before that, we suspected something was happening. But unfortunately, when you tell a doctor to look for certain diseases, there are so many testing to look for. So, and then it also runs into the cost of getting tested for the right disease, because they're testing you for everything, and that becomes expensive. Now that we narrowed it down to glass lung disease, as was commonly known, the doctors and the testing facilities can now test specifically for glass lung to make a confirmation on that, if that's the case.
All right, you can, the rest of
we also have to understand, that. Too, that the police officers,
all right, so that was another one of the people that testified at the UN. So it's becoming more and more apparent, kind of the sneaky things that they've been doing, like spraying us. I do want to remind people that there are pregnant women at camp, there are babies at camp, there are little kids at camp, there are elderly people at camp, there's all kinds of people at camp, and they're just spraying everybody indiscriminately. There was a pregnant woman that testified that was at one of the actions. She was in one of the, sort of in the role of pulling people out that had been injured and getting them out of the way. Her husband had told her to stay back because they were starting to use weapons on them. And this was on November 20th. And so the tactic of the police was they shot two combustion grenades into the air. And then while everybody was looking at the combustion grenades in the air, looking to see where they would fall, they shot more of them underneath their vehicles. One of them ended up landing right in between this pregnant woman and her friend, and it exploded in between them, and it hit her in the stomach. And when they took her to the hospital, the doctor said that if it had hit her 3 inches over, she would have lost her baby. So they're the amount of cruelty that I heard about and have seen also is unprecedented in any sort of action that I've ever seen. I've been manifesting at a protest since I was like 15. I've never seen anything like this before, and it's getting to the point that I can't call it anything other than an extermination. So if you want to know what it's like to live in a country that kills people for who they are and their religious beliefs, you're living in one. And they may not be shooting us in the face with, you know, and killing us right there, but I mean, we have to face the reality that we're probably, I already have problems with my liver. I'm probably going to suffer effects of this in the future. And it's a hard pill to swallow that we're at that point in this country, but we are. And I've seen it with my own eyes. We're there. Camp is right now, the Ocheti Shakoan camp, which is the big camp that people refer to, is the one that is on a floodplain. I talked to someone who's, he's a scientist of some sort, he told me, but his name is Boots, and that's what I remember, is that his name is Boots. But he came to help them with mapping out where the flood was going to be. And he said in old topography maps of the area where the camp is right now, it just says Lake Oahe. So it is definitely imperative that people leave. I did meet some people that are very reluctant to leave that area. The reason being is that that's technically Army Corps land, so the fact that we're camping on it was a victory in and of itself. But like I said, it will flood. That's not really a question. It's going to flood. The people have leased some more land to continue camps. There's a lot more camps popping up a few miles south of there to protest the Keystone Pipeline. LaDonna, who owns part of Sacred Stone, has also agreed to let campers stay on her land while they still can. So camp is still going to exist. It's going to exist in a different form, but camp is still going to exist. And we have to remember that camp, as a concept for the natives, was never a place to stay permanently. That's why you can move teepees. It was a place for them to stay until it was no longer safe or profitable to be there, and then to move along and to keep doing that as the seasons change. So that's what's happening to camp right now, is they're heading for higher ground, trying to establish more and more campgrounds in preparation for this fight, because it's becoming bigger and more people are becoming aware of it. And the police and the companies are just getting more vicious. So, other than the UN thing, and that's where camp is going, they were supposed to get the EPA out there this last Monday. We all know what happened with the EPA. So I highly doubt that's going to come to anything. Probably to explain what an unofficial UN hearing is, they had the head of the small group for indigenous people and businesses come to hear this testimony. So he is the actual head of the small group at the UN. And so what his job is now from this unofficial hearing is to go back to the UN and report the testimony that he's heard and the things that he's seen. They reportedly took him over to Sacred Stone camp. I'm not sure because I stayed at Ocheti the whole time. So, but apparently he got to tour the camp and meet some of the people and see where this is going on. In terms of what the UN can do, however, there's not a whole lot that the UN can do. The last time that the U.S. was taken to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, was by Mexico, actually. And then afterwards, it was kind of understood that that would never happen again. the United States is also one of four countries that decided to not sign the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights, which lays out very succinctly how we're supposed to be able to be free to worship, you know, what we prefer to worship on the land where we prefer to do it in the ways that we prefer to do it, and to protect that also for future generations. So in accordance with the UN Declaration, we all of the water protectors are completely within their right to protect that land for sacred use, which is what it is. I also heard from someone who was the person that they called to go out and identify the sacred sites that the court wanted so that they could kind of see where the pipeline was going to cross over, over these sacred sites. So they identified, I think it was like 67 of them, and it was 30-something burial sites. And when they went and turned in the report to the judge, the very next day, the Dakota Access Pipeline machine stopped what they were doing on the pipeline and went and bulldozed as many of these archaeological sites as they possibly could. So he sort of felt responsible for that happening, even though it's totally not his fault. They asked for that and then destroyed it. So yeah, I'm gonna actually open up the floor to questions. If anyone has, yes, David.
Right now, how many people are up there at these peripheral camps right now?
At Ocheti, I would say that there's 400 to 500 people still. It's still a pretty good bunch. There's many, many teepees. There's still a good legal team going strong up there. There's still about, I would say 4,500. And there's also Sacred Stone and Rosebud, which there are plenty of people there. I didn't go this time, so I didn't get a good eyeball.
I don't think we understand the difference of Sacred Stone.
Oh, okay. Ocheti's the big camp. Ocheti is the camp that's on Army Corps of Engineers land. And I also want to point out that this is only Army Corps of Engineers land because they seized it in the 90s. This actually used to be land that was part of the reservation, and their reasoning being that it flooded, so it was dangerous for native use. So Ocheti's that on that part of the land. So as a result of Ocheti being on that land, it is also subject to raids at any time. So every other day it was camp is getting raided. So that was fun. Because there's nothing you can do, and if they come, they're going to come from, 2 to 4 in the morning. And, I'm not going to sit up and wait for them, so I'm going to go to sleep. camp number ended up being raided, but it's definitely like a constant threat. Rosebud is right over the river. It's about 30 feet from Ocheti. The difference being is that Rosebud is on the reservation. It's on tribal land. It cannot be touched by the police, basically. And then Sacred Stone is just a little bit farther. I wish I could have a magic drawing tool. But we have like Turtle Island up here. This will be the Ocheti camp. This is Rosebud, the little camp here. And then over here we have Sacred Stone. And then the river runs like that. So we're all pretty clustered together. Sacred Stone, like I said, is the majority of it is on LaDonna's land, so it's her private land, and the police can't go there either. So Ocheti's always been the camp that's been under threat, quote unquote. All right, yes, Mike.
Did I understand you correctly that Keystone XL pipeline is right in that very neighborhood? Like
they're a little farther down south. I'd have to I haven't looked at like the exact map of where they're at, but they're one of the things that I talked to Manape, who's one of the leaders at camp. He's the only person in the world that has a Sioux passport. That was pretty cool. but he was saying I totally lost my train of thought there.
Can you re-ask the question?
Well, about the Keystone XL.
Right, okay, that's right, right. Okay, so he was saying that Trump signing the bill saying that the DAPL and the Keystone would go through. Problem is they're competitors, so you can't have both. So unless the Keystone is like going to lease part of the Dakota Access Pipeline, it's kind of hard to figure out how that's going to go. So down south, they have some of the Keystone pipeline, I guess, is getting ready to be, I think, start being built. So that's why they're pre-building the camps now. I think the camps have been open for about a month now. So. Yes.
Are the veterans still there?
Most of the veterans are gone. They all kind of cleared out after their stay. I did meet a couple of veterans that are still there. I also met Mary Pranksters. That was cool. I met Wonder Bread the Mary Prankster, the Ken Kesey style Mary Prankster. There's not really a whole lot of vets that are up there at all right now. It's pretty bare bones skeleton crew. So. All right, any other questions?
So I know, sadly, fortunately, people tend to avoid or ignore or avoid issues until they can see it. Is there any type of recording or anything else that's going on that so that people can see what's going on and see for themselves even though they're not there? I mean, like,
you know, dive bombings and... Absolutely. Everyone recognizes that if it wasn't for social media, that this whole thing would not have happened. It would have been something that nobody ever heard about that was squelched quickly. Thanks to social media, that did not happen. Facebook is going to be the best way that you can keep up on what's going on at camp. There's a lot of people that are dedicated to making live videos from camp. And the signal up there, actually, that was one thing that I found that had been significantly improved was I made a phone call to my mother in the middle of camp, and I was like, what is happening? It was the last time we had to walk all the way up to Media Hill and like wave our phones in the air. Hello? Can you hear me? I'm safe. Bye. Like that was pretty much all you could get out. My phone like shut off as soon as we got there and was just like, nope. But then it rang in my pocket 3 days later. Twilight Zone type stuff. It was crazy. But they even got their own Wi-Fi connection in the dome. So they had an internet cafe in the dome. It was very cool. The other thing I was very impressed by were the toilets. Let me tell you, compost toilets are the way of the future. Like, that was amazing. They had them set up in tents. They like built wooden stalls for privacy. They had wood stoves in there. They had attendance 24/7. Like, it didn't smell at all. Like, that's my like big thing about Johnny on the Spots. And it was like, I could chill in here all night. Like, this is great. Like, it was very luxurious. I liked it a lot. I was very into the compost toilets. So for future reference, if you're going to be having to poop outside, just take a little compost toilet with you and you'll be very happy. Also complete with bathroom graffiti. I loved it. Like, yes. Warriors, Mini Wichoni. Are there any other questions? Yes.
What kind of fears and what kind of pains do they have up there now that Trump has actually signed and gone ahead with this? I mean, are they preparing for escalation and what are they doing about that, if you can say anything?
Yeah, I certainly don't want to perpetuate any rumors or sort of, you know, anything that would be untoward, but a lot of people have the... the diehard, they're going to stay there until this is resolved. And a lot of people have given up everything to be at this. They've given up homes, they've given up jobs, they've given up, you know, their communities, and have given it all up to go here. So a lot of people don't have a home to go home to in that way. So they're invested that way in keeping the camp going because of that. And then the other hope is that it goes well in the courts. That's not something that, you know, we should rely on, I don't think. But, you know, it's the way that most of the, it seems that the council wants to take it is just through the courts and a sort of not really have the camp thing go on anymore. But, you know, then, like I said, there's campers that are do or die. They're going to be there until this is resolved. So mostly the plan now is to, you know, get to higher ground. And I see that they put out another call for people to join them. And I will tell you, if you're going to go up there, please be careful, especially in this weather. And if you don't have a teepee or some sort of yurt or like extreme weather building, like I wouldn't even do it. I had a heater in my tent. It was like one of those little portable buddy heaters. And it turned my tent into a sauna and it was awful. And I had to like turn it off and take all my clothes off because I was sweating like crazy. But it's hard to regulate temperature and sort of keep yourself comfortable while you're up there, unless you do have some sort of like semi-permanent living situation going on. So the future of the camps is really kind of up in the air. They'll still exist in some way, and I'm sure we'll, in the coming year, hear a lot more from the other camps that are starting to get set up there. So.
I love that social media has made a lot of the on-the-ground protests more visible than previous decades had. But at the same time, we all know that social media, all of them now, have algorithms which put preferred stories at the top. So knowing both of those things, what's the best way for interested people to continue following and sharing information about protests?
Specifically for Standing Rock, there's a couple of groups on Facebook that I would join. Here in Kansas City, we have the Red Road Way of Life is a good group to join. There's also the Concerned People or Concerned Citizens for the People of Standing Rock. It's a group like that. Unfortunately, my phone is being used to record, or else I'd be able to just like tell you right now.
Can we get links to those and put them on the Arts Bar page tomorrow?
We can totally do that. Standing Rock Rising is another page that you should follow. Standing Rock Rising is a man named Ryan Visions. His native name is Red Hawk. He's a Atlanta-based photographer. He's the one that's taken all of the really epic-looking photos, like the horse in front of like all the police tanks and that. He is a great person to follow. He actually, unfortunately, I didn't get to meet him at camp this time because he was at the Women's March, but he just got back to camp a couple of days ago. So he updates regularly about what's going on. There's also an Ochetti Shakowin Camp Facebook page that you can also like. And then from those groups, you can sort of find all of these live videos that people are posting. And, you know, Facebook and its algorithms, like you talked about, it'll start to kind of pull those things towards you the more that you search for them. So, you know, hashtag Standing Rock, hashtag Ochetti Shakowin, hashtag No DAPL, hashtag Mini Wuchoni will definitely lead you to stuff like that. There's also a rapper I really want to tell you about because he is awesome. Of course, I'm going to forget what his name is right now. Yep. I'm getting old, guys.
It's the uranium.
It must be the uranium. They've stolen all of my memories. But there's a really amazing rapper that's come out of Ochetti. And his name is like the simplest dang word. And I could just strangle myself because I can't remember it. But yeah, I'll post something up along with that. So. It's also really cool to see this art that's coming out of camps as well. So. All right. Anybody else? Question from
online. Is there a timeline on the UN response, and what are the needs and timeline for cleanup?
Timeline for UN response. That's kind of tough because the UN sort of works on its own timeline. the fact that we've had this unofficial hearing now means that we've gotten our foot in the door. Back in, I think it was December, the chairman, Dave Archambault, actually went to Geneva, to the UN, and I believe it was the result of that visit to have Pavel, and I cannot say his last name, so I'm not even gonna try, Pavel S., the leader of the small group, that was for him to come and see what was going down here, going on at Standing Rock down here. Timeline for the cleanup. When I first got to camp, they were giving everyone 30 days to get out of camp, and they were going to commence with the cleanup at that point, like all the final cleanup. Like I said, the reason I went down there was to mostly clean up, which is what I spent most of my time doing. But there is a lot to clean up. So while I was there, it changed from a month to a week. And then Manape said that they were going to bring in a lot of heavy machinery to kind of gather everything and get it together and then clean up from there. So I'm not sure how stuck on that, because I think the week, if they went by that timeline, it would be over, I think, on Wednesday. So I guess we'll see what happens on Wednesday. But as far as I know, the tribe is planning to pay for heavy machinery to come in and move all the snow and get all that crap out of there and move it out. So, all right. Any other questions online or otherwise?
Is it Vic Mensa?
I'm sorry?
Is it Vic Mensa?
Vic Mensa?
Is that the rapper you're thinking?
Oh, no. His first name, it's an actual word.
Prolific,
thank you. Yes, Prolific the rapper. That's who I'm talking about. Absolutely. Thank you, Keith. Keith also went to Standing Rock, so yeah. Thank you for telling. Yes, it's Prolific the rapper. Totally look him up. He's amazing. All right, well, if there are no other questions, I do want to thank you all so much for coming here tonight and listening to me ramble about camp. I hope that you have a much clearer picture of what's going on up there, sort of how the people are doing. I've also decided that in order to keep with the tradition, because they ask you when you go to camp to share what you've learned at camp with other people. So part of that is I'm going to be doing a class to teach protective strategies for when we need to manifest against our government so that we can keep each other safe. So I'm going to be doing those classes here pretty soon, so just kind of keep your eyes out for that, because fortunately I think we're going to need it more now than ever. Yeah. So, yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. I've had a great evening.
Have a good night. Thank you.